Accession number 27803, Mr. Vic Stone, Real 8. We're talking about a typical mission of these 8 or 9 you went on.
Yes.
So now, what would happen? So you've had your warning of a briefing. Now, what would happen at the briefing?
Well, after the briefing, you'd leave the briefing room. Right?
Now, hang on. What would happen at the briefing?
At the briefing, you're told where you're going. You're told how many containers, how many packages you got. You're told if you've got a dispatch rider.
What's a dispatch rider?
That is the man who is supposedly to push out all the gear. Other than that, they give you a rough briefing of weather.
Any special instructions as a wireless operator you might get?
No special instructions.
They wouldn't issue the codes, then?
If there are any special instructions, they will be given to you at a later briefing, you see. You'd have the final briefing, which was mainly a weather report, and that was it, you see, yeah. The pilot would have the... the codes, the dropping codes, and the areas, everything else, and the map reader. Obviously, he would have them because he's got his map. And in the meantime, he charts out where he's going on, and the navigator as well. He'll chart out to get the bomb aimer roughly there, and then the bomb aimer take over to get there. It's sort of narrowing it down. I mean, from here to Norway, right? The navigator would say, right, take course so and so and so and so until you get to 58 degrees so and so, and then you turn so and so. And he said, right, okay, Paddy, you're now over the coast of Norway. All right, Ron, you're going to take over now. And he'd say, yes, okay. And then he would take over, and he would map read the way in through the channel. You see, from here to Norway is the big drive, and then from Norway in is a smaller drive because you're getting nearer to the target, aren't you?
The two of them would be preparing that.
That's right, yeah, preparing their maps. And
any preparations you'd have to make as a wireless operator with your equipment or anything else?
No, none whatsoever, no.
So you didn't do any preliminary checks of the wireless?
Well, no, after the brief, when we had the first briefing, right, as I say, after the first briefing, you just went out. Invariably, you go to your aircraft, yeah? You go to your aircraft, and you'd have a word with the ground crew. And you'd say everything on board, and they'd say, well, yes, all okay, and you just topped up, yes. If there was time, they'd say, well, do you want to take it for an air test? Otherwise, the air test may have been in the late afternoon the previous day. Maybe you've been told in an afternoon, well, you take the aircraft up for a test at perhaps 5 o'clock or something, you know, take it out for a 20-minute test at such and such a time, and then you do it. That didn't mean to say that you were going to have an op that night, but half the time it meant that you could have had an op that night. They're getting your aircraft ready, but maybe they get 8 ready and only 4 go, you see, because maybe one or two have aborted before they get off because the weather over the dropping zone has changed.
So what next? You've gone out to your aircraft.
Yes, you go out to your aircraft. You jump all your aircraft.
You've gone out to the aircraft to do your preparations and talk to the ground crew.
In lots of instances, we will go out to the aircraft. You didn't have to. Sometimes we wouldn't go out. But if we went out, then we'd just have a chat with the air crew, with the ground crew, and say everything okay. They say, yeah, this is okay, that's okay. And they say, well, we did test this, we tested that, and if you want to take it for a test, you can take it for a test. And Paddy would say, well, no, that's okay.
And then what would happen after that?
You just go where you wanted to go until such time as the last briefing. And at the last, you could probably go and have a meal, you see.
Was there a special meal? I know there was a special aircrew breakfast, but was there a special meal before you went?
No, you could have more or less anything you wanted. I mean, aircrew breakfast, well, it was the same all the time, egg, bacon, sausage.
No special meal beforehand? It wasn't a formal thing?
No. Depending on the time. If you wanted a meal, you could walk in the mess any time and get a meal. That's one thing. If any time you wanted a mess, you would just walk in, and if you fancy something to eat, you could have it.
Now, at what point... So you'd have the final briefing...
Yes, you go for, they call it a final briefing, but that is mainly for the weather report. You know, you go for the final briefing and they say, well, look, you've got all the necessary that you need. You've got your route, your dropping zone, you've got everything there. The weather is much the same as it was earlier on, or it has deteriorated, but it could improve, or it's got worse, so you won't be going. It could be one of many, many things, all to do with the weather.
Now, when would you get kitted up in your flying kit? Before or after the flight?
No, after that, you get a crew bus and you go around to the parachute hangar, yeah, and you pick up your parachute and you may west, yeah? Because we didn't have flying kit. We never had any flying kit. No.
So what would you wear?
Just a pair of trousers and just one of those. Got a jacket. Jacket does up around the waistband here. That's all, just that. No gloves, nothing like that. So we weren't issued with them because we didn't fly high, so you didn't need them.
So you didn't have that problem with the cold? No.
We never had a problem. No. Then we get in the crew bus, which would take
us.
Hang on,
did you have an escaper kit? Escape kit?
You were given this. Yes, in the. When you went for your briefing, the earlier briefing, you'd have your escape kit.
And what was it? What would an escape kit be?
It's a small pack, and in there it would have dehydrated milk, tea, a bar of chocolate, Horlicks tablets, many different sorts of things. Needle and cotton, you may get a little pair of scissors or a small knife. It could be anything and everything.
Maps or currency?
No, we didn't have currency, no. We weren't allowed to carry anything like that at all, no. No, no maps, no currency. The bomber had maps, obviously.
Where you were going to be if you landed.
No, nothing like that at all, no.
Because the bomber crews had that sort of thing.
Oh, they did. They did, yes, yeah. Yeah. But no, we didn't have anything like that, no.
So
no. I think they always assumed that we wouldn't be high enough to get out if anything happened.
So the flying, you got into your minimal flying kit, which is just basically normal uniform.
Flying helmet. You need a flying helmet because of the phones, you know, and for your intercom, wouldn't you? You see.
So then, what? You picked up your May West and your
yes, your May West, your parachute, sign for them, getting the crew bus. So they take you out to the aircraft. You climb aboard the aircraft. They say put your parachute in the parachute stowage, but we just used to put them on the floor. We used to abuse them, really, I suppose, come to think of it. We just used to take them in and throw them somewhere, you know. And we used to, obviously, we keep our harness on and the May West, because the May West was the first. You see, you put your May West on first, and then your parachute harness goes over your May West. And then, if necessary, if you needed to shoot, the chute goes on the front of you. And that was a ripcord one. It's one which you pulled yourself. It wasn't a free-fall one. One with a cord where you just pulled yourself.
So you get on board the plane. Anything else? Any final checks on the aircraft?
Yes, the pilot would give a check, you know, and he'd say to the navigator, you know, you've got all your papers, you've got all you required there, is everything to your satisfaction? And he'd say, yes, check made, yes, okay. And he'd ask the bomb man, all right, yeah, check made, okay, yes. And he'd ask me, everything, oh, yes, check made, okay. The gunner, check made, okay. And the flight engineer, yeah, check made, okay. And then they would they call out to the ground crew to connect the trolley act. That's the trolley accumulator, you know, and he'd put that in. And then he'd give permission to start up the engines, and they'd start up the engines one at a time and get them all turning over. And then he'd ask the ground crew to stand back, and he'd just give them not a heavy rev up, but he'd give them just a... but make sure that the throttles are easy going, you know, make sure they're okay. And then he'd say, right, pull the chocks away. They pull the chocks away, You get settled in your seats, you sit there, and then Paddy would take the aircraft round to the edge of the perimeter, to the edge of the perimeter track. There he'd stop on the edge of the perimeter track. He'd have an instrument check, which is, they got a, it's not a leaflet, it's an instrument check then. Check your flaps, check the rudder, check this, check that. He goes right the way down and check this, check that. Make sure, and you say yes, or check made, and permission to take off. And then you'd wait, and the ACP on the end of the runway, it's just a caravan it was. And the chap would be in there with his oldest lamp, and he'd give you the green. And you'd taxi around from there to the end of the runway. And then you would wait there again, and then he'd give you another green, which meant you went away, and then Paddy would gradually open up the throttles, and a little bit more, and keep the nose down, and keep to one side, because they had this terrible problem of flying one side. The starboard engines always seemed to be more powerful than the others. And it was always a job. They used to have an awful lot of swing. I think half the aircraft they lost by accidents were lost on this swing. They used to swing off the runway. And it was a bad thing with this Sterling. That was a known fact about it. But no, and then he used to be airborne. And normally Ron would come up and sit in the pilot's seat when he was taken off. And then he would give him a hand to retract the undercarriage. And then he'd... You say, right, no, we set course now. What course do we set to Butch? You'd say, set so-and-so, north so-and-so, east so-and-so, wherever it was, you know. And then Paddy would turn, get on course, and he'd say about the height. Yeah, got the height right, yes. Course right, yes. He says, right, well, now we're on our way. And then we just used to sit back.
What were your duties? I mean, you mentioned it before, but I mean, just we're now in operations. What was it like? What was your duty on the wireless during an operation?
You sat and you listened for messages. This is the whole time. You listened out for messages, not only to you, but to others, because you could get a mayday call coming from somebody, and maybe I'd pick it up, maybe somebody else couldn't pick it up. So you always had to be there. And every 15 minutes, you had to tune in to your own station. So every 2 minutes, every 15 minutes, I'd have to tune in to ours. And on the mall, sort of, we had a very, very nice one, which was our radio. On the mall, of course, it's different, you see. And it was Snuggle. And I used to think that's a lovely, lovely term, and it's Snuggle. What's your call sign? Snuggle. That was really, really great, yeah. And
Do you maintain wireless silence yourself?
Yes, you had to maintain wireless yourself. Yes, sometimes I used to put a little bit of music on, you know, to cheer the lads up. But
on the intercom?
Yes.
Not on the wireless?
Oh, no, no, no.
So,
no.
Was it strict wireless silence?
It was strict wireless silence, yes. Very, very strict wireless silence, yes.
Were there any circumstances in which you could break it? As far as, I know there were, but what were the circumstances?
Only in emergency services, you see. I mean, if you're going down, if you're going down in the sea, or if you're going down somewhere, the idea was that your Morse key had a clip on it, and the idea is you throw the Morse key and you put the clip on, and that is sending out a continuous signal, you see. So they could pick up that signal, a radio station could pick up that signal, couldn't they? And they could find out where the aircraft is. If it's crashed, they could find out where it's crashed, or if it's gone in the sea, where it's gone in the sea. But providing they got enough time to get enough bearings on the aircraft to get it, you see, yes. Yeah. But no, other than that, there was nothing to do.
Tell me a bit about the intercom. How did the intercom operate? You mentioned you put music on. I'd like to hear a bit more about that. And did your pilot mind you talk? Some pilots had almost had silence on that as well. Tell me about the intercom.
Yes, he didn't like you talking a lot of unnecessary talk, because he used to say, "Look, we'll keep the talk to the essential talk." He used to call it, and that is, If he wanted to know the state of the engines from the flight engineer, if he got a reading on his engines and he may sort of query it with the engineer, he'd say, well, Jack, look, I've got so-and-so. What are your instruments? And he'd say, yes, that's okay, all right, fine. That was essential. He considered that essential talk because he wanted to make sure that he was right. See, if something varied on the instruments, normally the pilot would want to know why it has happened. And has it happened just to his instruments, or has it happened to the aircraft's instruments? Another thing was the icing up. You see, this was one of the things to make sure the blowers were okay, make sure that they didn't get iced up, because that was a bad thing over Norway, very bad thing over Norway. The icing there was terrible over Norway.
I'll come back to the icing. He didn't mind you putting music on the intercom, though.
No, I wouldn't put a lot on. No, maybe perhaps about 4 or 5 minutes before I listened to a broadcast, I may put something on. You know, there was always a program on. It was an American program called Duffel Bag, and it used to come on every hour on the hour. It used to come on, and they say every hour on the hour another Duffel Bag. You know, and they used to like to hear that for some reason, and they always had one or two quite nice tunes on there. And we've listened to one of those, or maybe you'd say, you know, I think you should turn the radio off. Or it depends where we were. If you're near cities or something like this, or near an airfield, then you've got to be more careful, you see. So he'd say, well, no, don't use the radio, keep silent.
Now, what was your position like? What were you doing? You were just, did you have a comfortable seat? What was the environment like for you?
Oh, it was lovely. I had a seat, quite a big seat. Like this, a big comfortable seat with pads on it, and up at the back, came up quite high, and it was armor plating on the back. The table laid out before me, everything was just so, the receiver and the transmitter and all the other little gadgets that you had in between, you know. And then at the side there was lots of valves to regulate oxygen and different, not we ever used it. I don't think we had any oxygen abroad. But they were well equipped for everything, but of course we didn't fly high enough to warrant using any of these aids.
What about just in case, did people ever use the latrine? Well, I presume you had an Elsan aboard.
There was an Elsan aboard, yes.
Did people use it?
I don't think so. I can't remember. Although Jack did say he went in the back once, but I don't know whether that's to use the latrine or not. I really don't know. I honestly couldn't say no.
But you didn't.
And I can't say I ever noticed the pilot or the bomber or navigator, because they'd have to go past me. They'd all have to go past me to get there, with the exception of the gunner. And I don't think the gunner could have got out his turret.
Where were most of your flights to? Were they, I mean, you've mentioned the one to France, but I get the impression France, most of them were to Norway.
France, Belgium, Holland. That was the three.
And so the Norway one was your first one, was it?
Yes,
when you
first and last.
Oh,
yes,
not shut down.
Yeah, first and last.
Yeah. Mm. Right. So it was in over. It's over in Northwest Europe.
In the Low Countries, isn't it? Mm.
Now, so what would happen as you start to get the other side of the channel, approaching the drop-in zone? Take me through it.
Mm, mm. Well, approaching the drop-in zone, I would get up in the Astrodome and keep an eye out.
Looking for
anything, you know, aircraft or a light from somewhere, or just generally looking around. You're not looking for a specific thing. You're just alert to anything unusual that's going to happen. You see.
What about flak or German fighters? Was there much of that?
No. Well, once again, you see, we were very fortunate. We were too low for the flak, so they couldn't fire at us. We were too too fast for the small arms. I mean, they couldn't fire at us with rifles or small machine guns, because we were going quickly. I mean, can you imagine the aircraft going over your head, you see, at 200 mile an hour, 150 mile an hour? They wouldn't have time.
What about German fighters?
Too low for the fighters, yeah, too low for them. They wouldn't come down that low, you see. I mean, and especially Norway. Norway is a treacherous country. I mean,
we're looking at the Low Countries one. We'll that last mission we'll cover slightly separately. So you're flying only low, no real risk of anti-aircraft or fighters. So
no, only once did we quite a few miles in the distance there was plaque we could see, but what it was, I don't know whether it was those after somebody else or got no idea at all, but it didn't bother us at all. We never had any bother whatsoever on any of our runs, no.
And what about the approach to the drop zone? You know, as you're getting closer and closer, this is where, yes, you said they took over, the bomber took over.
Yeah, the bomber takes over, and first of all, you see, he's looking for the signal, the same as I would be looking out the Astrodome, but of course I haven't got such a good vision as him, because we are running accordingly directly towards the dropping zone. So if we're running directly towards the dropping zone, in front of me is the cockpit and everything, which should be underneath me as well, so I wouldn't see it unless it's a number of miles in the distance. He would be the first one to see it, see, although Butch may probably just have a quick look out at the Astrodome, but on the whole, I would have Jack would have a look. If Jack was there, he'd probably just step on something similar to that. He'd just step on and look out the Astrodome to see everything happening. He'd just have a quick look around, and he'd get there, and I think, well, I'd have a look, and I'd have a quick look around, you know. But very seldom did you see anything. Once I did see a light going along a road, and it was just going along a road, it was up there, it was going along the road, and they must have heard their engines or something, and suddenly the lights went out and nothing, saw nothing else.
So you're getting closer and closer, and yes, the bomber is guiding you.
Yes, and it's looking down below, you see, through the cloud, or if it's no cloud, you can see lots and lots of water, because Norway is, I would reckon, three parts water, isn't it?
Norway was only the last one.
That was the last one, yes.
This is not Norway then?
You could see water, because in the Low Countries there's quite a lot of water, an awful lot of water, yes, yeah. A lot of these dikes as well. Oh, it does at night time, yes. Especially if you've got a full moon. You see, no cloud, if you've got a full moon, it shines up beautiful. You know, you could almost read a paper there. Yeah, yes.
What next? You're getting closer and closer.
Yeah, we're getting closer, and if he should happen to see a sign, he would say, I think I saw a sign, or it looks like a sign, or it could be a
what
sign
do you mean
down
by
there.
A sign?
It could be perhaps an X, a Y, or something in the snow, but with lights put down, you see. I mean, the signs, it wasn't necessarily from an oldest lamp, it wasn't necessarily from a lamp, it could be from the ground, you see. They put an X or a Y, it could be anything at all, it could be one, it could be two, it could be a question mark, it could be anything in the snow done with lights, you see, in the snow.
No, right, okay.
So it wasn't always, not always an oldest lamp. Could be an oldest lamp, it could be anything. But they had, wherever it was, it had to tally up. If there was a C on the ground, the oldest lamp had to flash C in Morse.
So then what?
Well, if there's nothing there, we would go round second time and have a look, second run in. If the cloud was too thick, depending on the pilot may say, well, look, we were due here at 22:04 and it's now 23, perhaps 29 or something. You know, we're very, very tight schedule. I don't think we've really got time for a second run around. Do you think we should do a tight turn round or this? And on one occasion we said, well, perhaps we could do one tight turn because it was fairly clear, and we said, well, we could do one tight turn. He did a tight turn, but it didn't do any good because we still never found anything.
And this was what was happening on nearly every mission. You weren't finding anything.
No. See, so many things. And in November, the Germans then, they were picking up these secret agents by the dozen. It was a very, very bad time for them. And they were shooting an awful lot of them at that time as well. Apparently there was given by the German command that any airman that came down should be shot. That was in the beginning of November that was given, yes.
So you on these missions over France, Belgium, the Low Countries, mostly you'd fly out there, and then either through bad weather or through them being dead or not able to contact you,
not able to contact
it was an
us.
Aborted mission.
Yes. Yeah.
Because it was tightly controlled by time above the thing.
So it was controlled by time, yes. Yeah.
So when a mission was aborted, what was the procedure? Did you have to ask, or did the pilot just abort it?
No, the pilot would be the one who would say we'll abort the mission, yes.
So what would happen then?
Yeah, he'd say, "Well, mission aborted. We'll return to base," and that was it. And then he'd say to the navigator, "You know, well, will you give us a course?" See, then the navigator may say to Bonmoma, "Well, whereabouts are we at the moment?" You know, because he'd been round and round. And the Bonmoma, having followed the detour of the ground, he knows exactly where he is. You see. So he would pick out something, and he'd say a certain amount of degrees, and it could be maybe a big factory or something. It could be, and he'd pick this out because all these things were itemised on the maps that he had: factories, rivers, bridges, everything was itemised on there. So he could quite easily pick out a pinpoint. And if he recognised a pinpoint, because he knew we was in that area, then he'd say, "That must be so-and-so." And he'd give him a course to fly, and he'd fly on that course, and then probably Butch would pick it up from there. But then he never did ever ask me for any bearings at all.
And on your flight back, anything special, or was it just the same as on the way out?
No, it's just the same as on the way out. You just sit there and occasionally look out the astrodome, make sure you're not being followed, and... You know, because all you could see is water, and that's a problem to tell how far down that is. You know, it could be 100 feet, it could be 1,000 feet. When you're looking at water, you've got no idea where you are at all.
What about coming into land? Was there any special procedure before landing?
He would ask permission first of all to get into the circuit. We come into land. We would ask for a flare path. Once again, had to be very, very, very close and very near before he'd ask for that, because there were cases down at Rivenhall where we were, where aircraft had been shot down over their base there, coming into and asked for a flare path.
Is Rivenhall Harwell?
Rivenhall or Harwell, yes. Yeah. because it was at Rivenhall that it was shot down. Yeah, sorry. But because I was thinking of the squadron, you know, but... there was one American one shot down there because they had base before us. Yeah, but that was Rivenhall. That's not hard.
So there was this risk that they'd follow you in.
Oh yes. There was a well known trick of theirs to follow them in and shoot them up. Oh yes, yeah. Yes. The one you saw, Gilly, Jim. He was shot then, wasn't he? Over his own room.
Now, what happened when you landed then?
When you landed, you circled a perimeter track to your dispersal. Got to your dispersal, cut the engines. The ground crew would then put the chocks under the wheels. They would open the hatch for you, or hatches for you. And you'd just come out of the aircraft. The crew bus will be there waiting. You get in the crew bus, you go around to the hangar, put your parachute in, put your May West in. If you wanted to, you could pull your chute to make sure it's going to work, but no, I don't know, but you did that. I think it's best if you didn't know, but you're allowed to do that. If you wanted to pull your chute, you could do that. But if you pulled it and nothing happened, you'd be very disappointed, wouldn't you? So I'm not known anybody to do it, but it's one of those things you're allowed to do if need be. Yeah.
Now, what about debriefing?
Debriefing,
especially if these were abortive missions. I mean, I presume the debriefing was quite important.
Yes. Debriefing. If you turn that over very, very quickly, that pad there, you'll find. No.
They can't see it, remember, so there's no point. If you tell them.
No, I was going to just show you what the... Well, I can tell you.
That's what you tell us, yeah.
Mm, yes, yeah. Well, when you get back, you go into the debriefing room and you sit at a table there and they ask you about the weather and did you meet any opposition, any flak places, you know. Did you notice any flak sites that we could put down, which we haven't already got notice of? They want to know everything that happens. If you saw a small light, a large light, whatever it was, you tell them everything. But mostly they're concerned with how the actual drop went. And
in your case, pilot, it hadn't gone mostly.
Well, no. But you see, the pilot would normally, I mean, in our case, the pilot returned for crew members missing. You see, well.
No. This isn't a typical raid.
Oh, yeah, I'm talking of Norway now, yes. No, you're talking.
We're still over the low countries.
Are we? Oh, right, yeah. Well, no, on the ordinary one, when you came back, you go for debriefing, you sit there, and as I say, they'd ask you what you did, what you saw, or anything of special interest. Even when you come back over the water, did you see any ships, any large ships, small ships, anything of special interest? No. And as I said, the weather, ask what the weather's like, and why is it you couldn't see the signals? Were there signals there and you couldn't see because of intermittent cloud or heavy cloud, 10-10 cloud? And you just explain the situation as you saw it. And that could be.
And there's no comeback about that. They just accepted it.
Well, yeah, they had to, didn't they? Because you got your load on board, you see, and that was it.
And what about the crew meal?
Well, the crew meal was after debriefing. We used to go in, and first of all, we used to get a jug of tea, or mug of tea, whatever we used to call it. We used to get tea, and then they used to say, well, what do you want to eat? We used to go and sit down, and they say, well, what do you fancy to eat? And it was normally the usual thing, you know. And they used to say, well, egg and bacon. Do you want egg? A couple of eggs, one egg. And that's bacon. Do you want? Do you want a sausage? Do you want mushrooms? Do you want baked beans with it? And whatever you wanted was more or less there for you to have. Plenty of milk as well. If you wanted milk, you could drink milk by the gallon. That was always there for you to drink, yeah. And we just used to sit there, talk amongst ourselves, and after the meal, we'd just go off to our respective huts and to bed.
And that was a typical raid, and you know, the six or seven that were aborted.
Yes, yes.